From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. China is literally gaining ground in a land and sea dispute with its neighbors. Rebecca Cruz joins me to discuss the country's rapid environmental transformation of an archipelago in the South China Sea.
China hasn't really listened, I guess, to any of this, or they're trying to assert themselves and have gone and started doing this landfill to try to extend the area, and as you said, for oil and gas, thought to be rich in the area, and then also for strategic purposes.
Then I'm joined by the grandson of a legendary civil rights leader in India, Mahatma Gandhi.
And he taught me that anger is like electricity. It's just as useful and just as powerful, but only if we use it intelligently. But it can be just as deadly and destructive if we abuse it.
Arun Gandhi on Lessons from His Grandfather, right after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlott. Rebecca Cruz, it's been a while since we've talked about the South China Sea, but let's remind ourselves this is a disputed area in Asia where China seems to be making a number of advancements there, working to develop an artificial island, and have made significant progress on this. Of course, this is the area known as the Spratly Islands. It's claimed by many others, including the Philippines and Vietnam. So what's China trying to do here? I mean, some suggest that they're really trying to provide an outpost, that it's new. It's now being called the Great Wall of Sand instead of the Great Wall of China, useful for military operations and access to oil and gas. Is this what basically is the bottom line here?
Yes, this is a power move by China. It's nothing new in this region. We've seen that they have disputed territories throughout the South China Sea. This particular group of islands, the Spratlys, not that close actually to China, and they're actually claimed by both the Philippines, which they are very close to, and Vietnam, both countries claiming that they have the legal right or the proximity right to have these islands. And China has disputed this going back for quite some time, but in 1988, for example, Vietnam and China got into a skirmish over this, and in fact, 60 Vietnamese sailors died. In 2012, we saw a standoff between the Philippines and China. A couple other instances have occurred as well. And in 2013, the Philippines said that they were going to take China to the United Nations Tribunal to try to deal with this dispute. China hasn't really listened, I guess, to any of this, or they're trying to assert themselves and have gone and started doing this landfill to try to extend the area. And as you said, for oil and gas, thought to be rich in the area, and then also for strategic purposes. And this seems very smart on their part, because who's going to stop them? They have the military capacity. They are a much larger country than both Vietnam and the Philippines. And the United States, though we have said that we are opposed to this, we are going to be doing some military exercises with our ally, the Philippines, we're probably not going to, we're not going to go to war over this. We are not going to be able to physically stop them. The other issue here is this is nothing new to Asia. A lot of Asian countries have been using sand to extend their land. Think about the environmental consequences of this, as so much land is taken back for these reasons. So other things to be concerned about as well.
Well, the satellite images of this are absolutely remarkable, so I would encourage everyone to take a look at those, and we will return to this issue in the South China Sea, I'm sure, in the future.
So. Yeah, it's not going anywhere.
Thank you very much, Rebecca.
Thank you.
You can find more details about this story and a map of some of the disputed territories on our website, kgou.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, at Worldviews KGOU, at Suzette Gorlott, and at Cruz226. Full episodes of this program can also be found on iTunes. Next, I'm joined by Arun Gandhi. He's the grandson of India's early 20th century nonviolent resistance leader, Mahatma Gandhi, and we'll talk about his work to carry on his family's legacy. I'm Suzette Gorlott, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlott. My next guest has spent more than 60 years spreading messages of peace and nonviolence around the globe. As a child growing up in South Africa under apartheid, Arun Gandhi was beaten by whites for being too black and by blacks for acting too white. He wanted eye for an eye retribution. But as he writes in his biography, he learned from his family that justice doesn't mean revenge. He's the grandson of the world-renowned Indian civil rights leader, Mahatma Gandhi. And Arun Gandhi regularly leads talks about lessons from his grandfather. Arun Gandhi, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your show.
Can you just tell us, first and foremost, kind of what those lessons that you learned from your grandfather might be?
Well, I lived with him between the age of 12 and 14, and I grew up in South Africa, where I suffered a lot of prejudice because of the color of my skin. And it filled me with a lot of anger and rage, and I wanted eye for an eye justice. And my grandfather, the first lesson he taught me was about understanding anger and being able to use that energy constructively and intelligently rather than abusing it. What happens today is that we get angry and we abuse anger, and that creates violence, and we just get more and more into a culture of violence. And he taught me that anger is like electricity. It's just as useful and just as powerful, but only if we use it intelligently. But it can be just as deadly and destructive if we abuse it. So he showed me how to use anger intelligently and trying to resolve issues and so on, which led to the second question of about relationships. You know, today our relationships are very bad because everybody is selfishly motivated. We all want to know what we are going to get out of a relationship, and if we don't get anything from it, why bother to cultivate a relationship? And that leads to all the conflicts that we face in life today. So he said relationships have to be built on positive principles of respect, understanding, acceptance, and appreciation. We have to respect each other and respect ourselves and respect our connection with all of creation. You know, we are not independent individuals. We are interdependent, interconnected. And we've got to respect that. And it's only when we respect that that we'll understand who we are and what we are and why are we here on earth. And when we understand that, then we will be able to accept each other as human beings and not identify people by the labels we have put upon ourselves. Today we have so many labels to identify people that we have forgotten that behind those labels there is a human being there. And it's only when we are able to accept people as human beings, then we will be able to appreciate our own humanity.
So you mentioned using, and this is such a great way that you put this and that your grandfather put this, to use your anger or your outrage, your resentment, these types of negative feelings in a more positive way, mm-hmm. and use it, as you said, intelligently, which would indicate that you're using your cognitive capabilities, that you're using reason, that you're, you know, using your brain, for lack of a better word, right? But we often find that we react passionately and emotionally to anger. I mean, it's a feeling, right? So when you say that justice should be sought in things like love, respect, that these are feelings that we have. And so how do you make that transition from thinking about reacting in a respectful way or, you know, in a nonviolent way to some sort of violence and stop that emotional, passionate response?
Well, that's true. What happens is we colloquially we say that when a person is angry, he is mad. And literally, he is mad because he's not in control of his mind. When he loses his temper, he's just crazy. And to do something in that kind of state of mind is always going to be destructive. So it's important that we stop ourselves from acting in a moment of madness, take control of our mind and think of the issue, and not focus so much on the person but on the problem and find a solution to that problem. For that, we need to have some mental capacity, mental exercises. You know, we do a lot of physical exercises to have a healthy and strong body, but we don't do any mental exercises to have a healthy and strong mind. And that is where meditation and learning to control your mind comes in very handy. What he made me do was to hold in front of me a flower or a picture of somebody that I liked. And for one minute, I had to focus on that object and then shut my eyes and see for how long I could keep that image in my mind's eye. In the beginning, when I closed my eyes, my image vanished. But when I began to do this exercise regularly, I found that I could keep that image longer and longer. And to that extent, my mind was coming under my control. And so when you get into a situation when you are angry and mad, then you don't flare up and you take control of your mind and move away from the situation if necessary. But do something to regain control of your mind and then find an adequate solution.
That is very great advice and very concrete advice that we can use to move forward. But I'd like to ask about some of the work that you've done around the world on these issues. I mean, obviously, you're a sought-after speaker and somebody who's engaged in these types of activities, living out the life of an activist in promotion of nonviolence. But you've also gone back to India, and even though you spent most of your time, your childhood, in South Africa, and have set up a lot of social programs there, helping millions of people. Tell us a little bit about the work you've been doing there and why you were drawn back to India.
Well, that was part of the philosophy of nonviolence, where we become more conscious of people around us and the pain and agonies that they have to suffer. And so when I was kind of, in a sense, exiled to India because the South African government wouldn't allow me to bring my Indian bride back with me to South Africa, I was forced to live in India. And when I saw all the poverty there, I realized that we need to do something to help these people get out of that cycle of poverty. And so my wife and I and some friends, we devoted our time to using grandfather's philosophy in trying to find adequate solutions. And those programs have been very successful, and they are now going on their own momentum and, you know, still bringing about a change in people's lives. And then more recently, I started a program to rescue children who live in poverty. We still have millions of children in India and all over the world, in fact, and all over the developing world. There are millions and millions of children who live in extreme poverty who are unable to get out of that cycle. And I've started this program to rescue these children, to train them and rehabilitate them so that they can come back into mainstream society, give them some education, and hopefully, equip them to become useful citizens.
I'm speaking with Arun Gandhi, the grandson of India's civil rights leader, Mahatma Gandhi. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Gorlat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. My guest this half hour is Arun Gandhi. His grandfather led nonviolent resistance movements in India and South Africa during the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Mahatma Gandhi is widely regarded as the founding father of modern India and was assassinated in 1948, less than 6 months after the country achieved independence. Well, education has been a big part of your work in general. You've started a couple of institutes, the M.K. Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence, which is actually centered in Memphis, Tennessee, as well as the Gandhi Worldwide Education Institute. And both of these institutes and of course, the work you're referring to in India is very much motivated by educating others about these types of ways in which we can program ourselves and react in more constructive and helpful ways. But I thought it was interesting in your Institute for Nonviolence in the United States that you're prioritizing programming for people between the ages of 12 and 24. So you're focusing on young people and helping them, training them to have skills in nonviolent communication and meditation, as you were mentioning, these very important practical things you can do, interconnectedness and sustainability. So I believe it was founded in Tennessee, but then it moved to New York, right?
It's moved to Rochester.
So tell us a little bit more about that particular project, and obviously the focus on youth, I would presume, is an effort to try to influence the future generations of violent activities.
Exactly. The purpose of this institute was to make people aware that nonviolence is not just a tool to be used when convenient. It is about personal transformation. You know, we have got so trapped in the culture of violence that everything we do, our language, our sports, our entertainment, our relationships, everything is governed by that culture of violence. And the only solution for this is to break out of that culture of violence and adopt a culture of nonviolence, which means that each one of us has to become the change that we wish to see in the world. So I'm trying through this institute to influence young people that they can be the change in the world, that they can make a difference in this world and make it less violent. I won't say that we can create a utopian society where there won't be any violence, but we can certainly reduce the level of violence where we can all live in peace and harmony with each other. And part of the program is to take these students and even adults, whoever wants to come, on a Gandhi legacy tour of India, where we go to various village and slum areas where individuals, using Gandhi's philosophy, are constructively bringing about a change in the lives of the poor people. And they study these programs for 2 weeks and go around the country and see them and learn from them how nonviolence can be used in everyday life to bring about small changes in the lives of people. So these are the programs, and as I said, the Gandhi Worldwide Education Institute was started more recently, and that is focused more on trying to help the children in poverty and trying to bring them out. And it has a very ambitious program. We want to have these kind of centers in all the developing parts of the world where there's extreme poverty. But that needs a lot of money, and we're struggling for money like everybody else.
Well, you mentioned focusing on children, but you're also focusing on parents. I mean, that's an interesting part of it, is that the parental involvement and the importance of how parents are raising their children.
Exactly. That is where, you know, violence is not our natural nature. It's something that we learn, and the way we learn it is the way we are brought up. And, you know, it's like when a child misbehaves, we punish the child. And that punishment is the first seeds of violence we are planting in the child's mind, saying that anybody who misbehaves has to be punished. What in a culture of nonviolence, it's not punishment, it's penance that is important. And we were brought up in that kind of a nonviolent home, and our parents didn't punish us when we misbehaved. They did penance. They fasted, depending on how serious the offense was. They fasted for half a day or full day or 2 days. But they would sit at the table, they would feed us, and they would talk to us, and they would tell us that they were not eating because they were not good parents. And they didn't teach us the right way of behavior. And because the relationship between the parents and us children was based on mutual love and respect for each other, we felt awful when our parents had to do that. And we made sure that we didn't do that again. So it's all of these things that combine, you know, that love relationship between parents and children, and then penance, teaching us nonviolent ways of dealing with situations and so on.
So now that you've been working in this area, and obviously your background is remarkable, and just that the story you're telling right there about the importance of parents and how your parents raised you is just absolutely remarkable. But we still see a lot of violence around the world. It's, you know, you can't turn on the television without seeing what's going on around the world today. So how How do you stay motivated? How do you stay focused and positive and optimistic about the work that you're doing? I think this would be really helpful for the rest of us to learn how to keep moving forward on this type of work when what you see often is so depressing and demoralizing.
Well, I think that's where my grandfather's advice and my parents' advice came in very handy when they said that don't have high expectations. Don't think that you can change the whole world, but just do what you have to do and be happy with small changes that take place. My parents would always say that you should consider yourself to be a peace farmer. And just as a farmer goes out into the fields and plants seeds and hopes and prays that he gets a good crop, you just go out and plant seeds and hope and pray that those seeds will germinate and you get a good crop.
So you're living by example in many ways, but you obviously have to have the exposure to mm-hmm. others in order to set that example and to demonstrate how to move forward, right? So engaging in some sort of broader community discussion is really necessary.
Yes, it is. And whenever I get an opportunity like this, coming to a university and speaking to students or radio and newspaper interviews and all, I take those opportunities and spread the word as much as possible.
Well, we're so grateful that you've come here and very grateful for the work that you're doing. You know, today's times are very trying, as you know.
It's very trying and it's very disheartening at times.
But it's important that we're having these conversations and the legacy, obviously, your grandfather left and your parents to you and the work that you're doing and that you're keeping this up. I hope you feel that the legacy you're leaving is going to be carried on as well by those of us who are learning from you.
Yes, I'm hoping and praying that that happens. And I can see that happening in my children. My daughter and my son are both involved in it, and they're carrying on the legacy. So it won't die with me, but it'll continue.
Well, we'll all be looking forward to hearing from you in the future and paying attention to the very important work that you're doing. And we thank you again for the work that you do, but also for being here with us on Worldviews. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
You've been listening to my conversation with Arun Gandhi, the grandson of the Indian civil rights leader Mahatma Gandhi. There's more information and links to some of the foundations he mentioned on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between KGOU and the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Symphony Swift oversees our research and books the guests. Sam Dupre prepares our build-outs for the web. And Brian Hardzinski produces the show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gorlott.